Tonight's reading is taken from John's Gospel, chapter 15, which can be found on page 1083 of the Church Bibles. That's page 1083. Starting to read at verse 26. When the Counselor comes, whom I will send to you from the Father, the Spirit of truth who goes out from the Father, he will testify about me. And you also must testify, for you have been with me from the beginning. All this I have told you, so that you will not go astray. They will put you out of the synagogue. In fact, a time is coming when anyone who kills you will think he is offering a service to God. They will do such things because they have not known the Father or me. I have told you this, so that when the time comes, you will remember that I warned you. I did not tell you this at first, because I was with you. Now I am going to him who sent me, yet none of you asks me, where are you going? Because I have said these things, you are filled with grief. But I tell you the truth, it is for your good that I am going away. Unless I go away, the Counselor will not come to you. But if I go, I will send him to you. When he comes, he will convict the world of guilt, in regard to sin and righteousness and judgment. In regard to sin, because men do not believe in me. In regard to righteousness, because I am going to the Father, where you can see me no longer. And in regard to judgment, because the prince of this world now stands condemned.
The little orange light showing on the dashboard in front of him. He's not a particularly practical creature. It was an old car. I guess he thought that probably the little orange light didn't mean anything. In fact, it did mean something. As the mechanic who came to start the engine for him at the end of the evening tried to explain to him, he'd been driving for 25 miles with a starter motor still on, and that was why it needed a new one. Now, if you're a newcomer tonight, we're studying a passage from John's Gospel where Jesus tells us about God's generosity to us, his kindness to us, in providing the spiritual equivalent of three warning lights, three warning signals which make it clear to us that we're in spiritual danger and that we need to do something about it urgently if we want to avoid spiritual destruction. Turn with me, if you would, to that passage which was just read, page 1084, John chapter 16. Jesus speaking to his disciples on the night before he died, and John the Gospel writer records the conversation for us to help his readers understand what's involved in becoming a Christian. And last week, if you were here, we saw how John reassures us that the teachers appointed for us by Jesus really are authentic and trustworthy, in spite of the fact that ever since he appointed them, they've always been in the doghouse. John wants us to know we can really rely on those teachers, whatever anybody else may say about them. Well, tonight we'll see how John, the Gospel writer, turns his attention from the men who bring this message to us to the impact which their message makes on us, the way their message comes home to us. It's as if John is concerned to help us understand our own experience as we come into contact with Jesus and with Christian friends or colleagues, as we begin to understand more of the Christian message for ourselves. And what John, the Gospel writer, does, I think we'll find, by recording this particular conversation for us, is to explain some of the warning signals that we may find ourselves receiving, some of the flashing lights that we face as we hear more for ourselves about Jesus, see what sort of man he was and what kind of life he lived. And John is concerned to make clear to us that these warnings are signs that God himself is at work in our lives, that he's taken the trouble to put them there. He's warning us of the danger that we're in. And although it may be rather inconvenient for us, he wants us to stop the car and ask for his forgiveness and get off the road which leads to destruction and turn around and head off in a totally new direction towards a different destination. So these warning signs, although they may seem uncomfortable, they're designed to make it clear to us that the situation we're facing is urgent, that disaster is imminent, and that it's not worth risking it, carrying on for a few miles more, see if we can make it. And again, a bit like last week, I particularly want to speak to you tonight if you've only recently begun to experience these warning signals. I want to urge you to respond to them, to reassure you that these things that are going on, if they are going on for you, are a sign of God's concern for you. Well, let's read the heart of the passage again just for a moment, and then we'll look at each warning signal in turn. Verse 5, page 1084. Jesus speaking. Now I am going to him who sent me, yet none of you asks me, where are you going? Because I have said these things, you are filled with grief. But I tell you the truth, it is for your good that I am going away. Unless I go away, the counselor will not come to you, but if I go, I will send him to you. When he comes, he will convict the world of guilt in regard to sin and righteousness and judgment. In regard to sin, because men do not believe in me. In regard to righteousness, because I am going to the Father where you can see me no longer. And in regard to judgment, because the prince of this world now stands condemned. Just a word or two more on the setting. Do you see, Jesus is looking forward to when God's Spirit will come after his own death and resurrection. When God's Spirit will come to these first disciples. That's the setting of this particular conversation. And Jesus calls God's Spirit the counselor, which doesn't mean that anybody elects him or goes off to consult him. The original word means one who draws alongside, some kind of helper. And the point of the paragraph we're going to study is to understand what kind of help we can expect. You see in verse 8, Jesus says that God's Spirit will convict, or we could say convince, or show people that they're guilty before God in these three areas. And for these three reasons, as we'll see. So again, John is showing us that it's God himself who's responsible for these warning signals so that we can know what to make of them when they begin to show themselves in our lives. They appear on the dashboard. Why? Not because there's an electrical fault, but because the manufacturer has put them there for our benefit. It's the work of his Spirit to turn them on, to bring them to our attention, to bring home to us the need to respond to him. Well, let's get down to the details of what these three warning signals are saying to us. Here's the first. We are wrong about Jesus. We are wrong about Jesus. Look at verse 8 with me. When God's Spirit comes, Jesus says, he'll convict the world of guilt in regard to sin and righteousness and judgment. There are the three signals. And here's what Jesus tells us about the first one, by way of explanation. Verse 9. In regard to sin, because men do not believe in me. So that first flashing light is saying to us that we're guilty of sin. And sin is not a word, actually, that most people take all that seriously today, is it? Try and experiment if you doubt that. At work tomorrow, wherever you're going to spend tomorrow, ask them around the office what they understand by sin. Just think for a moment about the kind of answers you would get. It'd be a slightly embarrassing pause, wouldn't it? Because you're not supposed to talk about that on Monday. You're supposed to keep that kind of thing for Sunday. It's embarrassing. But supposing you got beyond that and you were able to get some kind of answer from them, what would they say? I guess most people would find it hard to talk about it. They'd certainly find it hard to be clear about what it means. And sometimes some of us are not much better, are we? The Bible uses all kinds of picture language to explain what it means by sin. In some places, sin is just another word for rebellion. It speaks of the way we refuse to recognize God's authority over us. We prefer to drive at our own speed, to choose our own road. Other times, sin is a way of talking about not quite making it, falling short of God's standards, missing the target that he's set for us. Or sin can be a way of expressing the fact that our lives are spoiled or stained when God sees them. Our friends may see us differently, but we know that there are things we've done which are, in our experience, like a wine stain on a napkin. They're impossible to remove, however hard we try. And other times the Bible uses the language of banking, commerce, to talk about sin. It's as if it was the same as spiritual bankruptcy. A massive debt that we owe to God that we can never hope to pay. But in verse 9, Jesus is really quite specific in what he says about what sin means. He's perfectly clear about what this particular warning light means, which may just have started flashing in our experience. It's the sin of not believing in Jesus. The sin of not listening to Jesus properly, of never having taken the trouble to listen to his teaching, as those people who were interviewed earlier have taken the trouble. Many of us have not done that, of not bothering to learn from his life, because we're too busy just quietly doing our own thing. Or it's the sin of not treating Jesus properly, and many of us do that simply by ignoring him, because we know only too well that he doesn't like some of the things that we're doing. It's the sin, if you like to put it like this, of driving along without thinking about him, as if the car was our own and we really could choose our own destination. It's the sin of living as if we didn't need Jesus. And according to Jesus, God's Spirit shows us that whatever we may think about it, our situation, if we have been living like that, is really very serious. He shows us that the way we've been treating Jesus is disastrous, that God is offended by it, and that we'll have to answer to him for it, and that he'll certainly punish us for it. And Jesus is saying that God's Spirit goes on warning us whatever we may feel about it. He goes on doing it even when we're not particularly keen on it, and even if when we try to escape from it. That warning signal goes on showing itself to us. And I guess a good many of us who are now believers may easily remember how uncomfortable that can be. And it's only now that we have taken action and become a Christian that we're in a position to look back and to thank God for going on with his warning for us, even when at the time we were fed up with it. Well, there's the first flashing light, the first warning signal, which Jesus tells us here that God's Spirit switches on in different people's experience. It's the sin of rejecting Jesus. And that first warning signal shows us that we're wrong about Jesus. And God bothers to send it because he doesn't want us to go on driving towards destruction. Well, now for the second warning signal. If the first one tells us that we're wrong about Jesus, the second one warns us that we're morally hopeless. We are morally hopeless. Look at verse 8 again. We're back in verse 8. When the Spirit comes, he will convict the world of guilt in regard to sin and righteousness and judgment. In regard to sin, because men do not believe in me. And now here comes the second one and the reason for it. In regard to righteousness, because I am going to the Father where you can see me no longer. I'm going to take the signal and the reason for it separately. Jesus says that this next work of God's Spirit is to convict the world in regard to righteousness. And it's not immediately obvious what he means. But this second warning signal, which God's Spirit switches on for us, is rather similar to the first one. It's designed to make it clear to us that there's something wrong with our righteousness. If you're a Christian person, maybe this was something like your experience. What happens sometimes is this. We're going along fine. And for the moment, the job is okay, or the course is going reasonably well. We find that we've got a few friends, never enough, but a few. We're reasonably pleased with ourselves, in fact. We seem to be doing all right for ourselves. And then gradually, or for some people, really quite quickly, it's as if we're being forced against our will to see a new side of ourselves. Maybe the catalyst is a relation coming unstuck or something going wrong in the family. Those things can happen to anybody. But we have to admit that some of the things she accused me of were true. And then perhaps somebody has a drink or two too many and passes on some home truths in a pub. You know the kind of thing? And some of them were true as well. And then if we're at work, the boss takes it into his head to make it clear that we're not actually doing quite as well as we thought we were. And we find ourselves being forced to face up to what we're really like as others see us, and just as if we're honest as we know ourselves to be, beneath the surface, behind the smile. Well, you may not have had that experience, but for some, it's a bit like that little red oil can, which lights up to make it clear to us that there's something wrong with the oil pressure. And if we ignore it for too long, we'll almost certainly do something terminal to the engine. Well, it's even more dangerous to go on ignoring God's warning signals to us. We can always buy a new engine, but nobody pays their way out of hell. But why then do we need God's Spirit to turn on that kind of warning signal for us? I guess one reason is because most of us drive along for most of the time as if nothing was wrong. I know of somebody who drove a tractor across a field, listening to the radio inside the cab. And he was blissfully ignorant of the fact that he'd driven off without the trailer and broken all the hydraulic pipes. My father was very unimpressed indeed. And most of us go on living as if we really thought that God was impressed with our performance, in blissful ignorance of the way he actually sees us. But if you look in verse 10, that's not the reason that Jesus gives us for this particular work of God's Spirit. Look at verse 10 again with me. Jesus says that this second work of God's Spirit is necessary for what sounds at first very surprising. It's a surprising reason. He says, because I'm going to the Father where you can see me no more. Which doesn't seem immediately obvious as explanations go, does it? It's like the average accountancy textbook. But if we remember some of the ways in which Jesus exposed wrongdoing during his own lifetime, the way that Jesus showed up the emptiness and the shallowness of the so-called righteousness that was all around him by his teaching and his example, then I think we may be able to make sense of verse 10. What did Jesus do? Well, by explaining God's truth to them and by living a perfect human life among them, he showed person after person what was wrong with their righteousness. For instance, if you're a reader of John's Gospel, chapter 3, he showed a man called Nicodemus what was wrong with his righteousness. And that was a big shock for Nicodemus because he was a man with superb spiritual credentials. In our terms, he was the equivalent of a bishop or a professional theologian. I'm not going over that ground again. Jesus told Nicodemus that he was nowhere with God and that he needed to start all over again. Well, when we realize that Jesus often showed people what was wrong with their righteousness during his life on earth, well, then now are we in a better position to understand verse 10? Look at it again with me. Jesus says that this next work of the Spirit is going to be necessary. The Spirit is coming in regard to righteousness. Why? Well, because he is going. And the disciples won't be in a position to learn any more from him and see him in action. In other words, the Spirit is coming to carry on the same kind of work that Jesus has been doing, because Jesus himself is not going to be around much longer. Jesus can't show them what's wrong with their righteousness, so the Spirit will carry on and do it in just the same way that Jesus did. It's as if the Spirit comes on as a substitute for Jesus, takes over his role on the field. Jesus is going to leave the field by way of a cross. The Spirit comes onto the field to take his place. But then how in practice does the Spirit carry on with the work that Jesus was doing when he was around? How does the Spirit show us that there's something wrong with our righteousness? We need to know that if we're going to know that he's been doing that in our experience. How does he make it clear to us if we're morally hopeless? Well, I'm not here to say how he's going to work in different people's lives. He works in a variety of different ways in different lives. But he often shows us what's wrong with our own righteousness by showing us someone else's. He does it by putting us in touch with a genuine Christian. And so someone moves in next door, or comes to work in the same office, or someone plays for the same team, and sooner or later it emerges in conversation that he or she is a Christian, a real one. And then God's Spirit gradually shows us what makes her tick, and we meet some of her friends, and it's clear that, well, they're not actually a bunch of boring stuffed shirts after all. And then we see him under pressure, trying to meet a deadline. And we can see that whatever it is that he or she has got, it's real. And it really does make a difference to her. And a warning light is gradually turned on in our experience. And it begins to dawn on us that, well, maybe there's something wrong with our own righteousness. And then we begin to talk and think and read and learn about Jesus. And it becomes more and more obvious But the problem is serious. We really are morally hopeless. Again, may I say, if that's been happening to you in just a little way recently, then I want to urge you not to ignore what God's Spirit may have been doing, not to risk it and drive on as if everything was fine. It's just not worth it. If God's Spirit has graciously been showing you that there is something wrong with your righteousness, then you need to do something about it before too long. Well, there's that second warning light which God's Spirit graciously switches on for us, warning us of the spiritual dangers we're facing. He shows us first that we're wrong about Jesus. Then second, he makes it clear to us that we're morally hopeless. And now the third warning signal, the third conviction which God's Spirit gradually brings home to us. And it's this. We're spiritually clueless. We're spiritually clueless. Again, we're back in verse 8 with Jesus speaking. When God's Spirit comes, he'll convict the world of guilt in regard to sin and righteousness and judgment. In regard to sin, because men do not believe in me. In regard to righteousness, because I'm going to the Father where you can see me no longer. And here's the third. In regard to judgment, because the prince of this world now stands condemned. And once again, we'll take the warning signal, the little light on the dashboard, and the reason for it separately. Jesus says that this third work of God's Spirit is to convict the world in regard to judgment. And again, he's not talking about God's judgment. God's Spirit works in the world to make it clear there's something wrong with the world's judgment. God's Spirit works in us, if he's doing that, if we're not yet believers, to make it clear there's something wrong with our judgment. Just as he shows us that we're wrong about Jesus and that there's something wrong with our righteousness. Well, what is wrong with our judgment if we're not yet at the position of believing in Jesus? Well, let me try and show by two or three different ways of explaining the process by which we reach that conclusion. The Bible uses a range of different language to talk about this. The language of ignorance, spiritual ignorance, of blindness, and of spiritual stupidity. It's really complimentary, isn't it? Let me try and give you a flavor of each one. And the easiest way, I think, to do that is to appeal to the experience of someone who is now a believer. And from that perspective, from the perspective of someone who has crossed over that line and does now believe and is in a position to look back, then I think they can tell you about how this happens in their lives. So those of us who are believers, I think, can remember a time when it began to dawn on us that we were spiritually clueless, that our judgment spiritually was utterly worthless. And again, that can happen to different people in different ways, but it may have happened as we began to talk to a Christian friend or read a book or bits of the Bible or began to go to meetings. God's Spirit gradually made it clear to us. We gradually came to realize that we were completely ignorant of spiritual reality. It dawned on us that we knew nothing at all of genuine spiritual experience. And that can come as quite a surprise to some of us, especially if we thought of ourselves as being religious. Well, if ignorance is not an idea that makes sense, do you try blindness? Many of us, again, who now believe, remember a time when we began to see that for the whole of our lives we'd been suffering from a kind of spiritual short-sightedness. I guess some of us may have known genuine Christians off and on for years, long before we became Christians ourselves. And we may have been genuine friends with them, but we were always slightly amused by them or enjoyed teasing them. I remember a student called No Score Norman. And although Norman's friends were genuinely friends with him, they were quite incapable, as far as they were concerned, of seeing what Norman seemed to see. And as far as they could see, there was nothing at all that would justify Norman's stand. It made no sense. That's why they called him Norman No Score. And that's true of all of us before we become Christians. until God's Spirit makes it clear to us that we're suffering from a form of spiritual blindness. And was Norman right, or was he wrong? Or put another way, sometimes God's Spirit, as he gets to work in us, makes it clear to us that we've been suffering from a kind of spiritual stupidity. And again, he does it in a variety of different ways. Maybe he takes us to our bookshelves, shows us a number of different books that we used to read before we began to believe. Makes it clear to us that the spiritual, pseudo-spiritual stuff that for all those years we've been taking desperately seriously is simply rubbish. Shows us that our spiritual judgment is worthless and that we were in a position of being spiritually clueless. But if the experience of God's Spirit working in different ways is not too hard to describe, and I don't think it's too hard to understand, why is it necessary? Why does God bother to send his Spirit to us for this third and final warning signal? What's the reason for it? Again, Jesus explains in verse 11. And it's an unusual explanation. He says, because the prince of this world now stands condemned. It's not as hard as it may seem at first. If you're a Bible reader, you'll know that the prince of this world refers to Satan, a powerful spiritual rebel against God, not as powerful as God, but determined to do whatever he can to damage God and destroy as many lives as possible. The Bible makes it clear to us that from the moment Jesus came into the world on his rescue mission, there's been a war on. There are a series of skirmishes as Satan tried one tactic after another to destroy Jesus. At this point in the story, it's coming towards a climax. Jesus is about to be executed, and it looks as though Satan will win and Jesus will be defeated. And if you ask them in the office when you finish talking to them about sin, ask them what they make of the cross. Ask them how they think of what happened when Jesus died. What kind of sense they can make of it. Because there are many people who think of the cross today in those terms. They see the death of Jesus as a tragic disaster. The place where he was condemned, where he died a pointless death. And most people who are not yet believers are in a muddle about the death of Jesus on the cross. They're just not quite sure what to make of it. They know they don't really understand it. And I guess that may be your experience at the moment. Well, Jesus looks forward to his death on the cross in this verse. Not as a defeat, but as his greatest victory. He sees it as the key to his rescue mission. He sees it as the moment when he was going to die to break the power of God's enemy. Follow it with me in verse 11. He says, now, looking forward to the death on the cross, now is the moment when God's great spiritual enemy is finally defeated and condemned to ultimate destruction. But there's still another question. What on earth has all this got to do with the work of God's Spirit in us? How does what Jesus says here about his death connect with that warning signal that shows us we're spiritually clueless? I think it goes like this. I think Jesus is saying that we need God's Spirit to work in us to show us our spiritual ignorance and blindness, especially in this area. Because without the work of God's Spirit, we can make no sense of the cross. We easily miss the whole point about the death of Jesus. We fail to see its significance. Does any of you know those magic eye pictures? I guess most families have been through a craze just about last Christmas. They were all the rage for Christmas presents. Certainly they were in our household. You sit there for ages with one of these books over your nose, try not to look embarrassed, and then gradually you take it away and hope you're going to see something. And the crib at the back tells you it's going to be a picture of Mickey Mouse or the Empire State Building or something, and the book gets further and further and further away. Nothing. That been your experience? A whole series of red dots that start to swim, and your eyes over the course of the weekend or the week's break go more and more bloodshot as you try to make sense of these wretched pictures and see 3D that everybody else talks about all the time. Well, if you're not a believer, the cross is very much like one of those magic eye pictures. Just a series of meaningless dots. There's no depth or meaning or significance to it. Until God's Spirit gets to work in us and takes us beyond the point where he shows us that we're spiritually clueless and takes us in shows us what the death of Jesus really means. And those of us who've been believers, become believers in adult life, can look back to that experience. At some stage, the death of Jesus began to make sense to us. Somebody explained it on the back of a beer mat or in a meeting or whatever it was. We began to realize that we had been completely missing the point. And gradually, the meaning of the cross came into focus for us. Well, again, if that's been your experience, and I guess that's most of us, wouldn't tonight be a good night to say thank you again to God for sending his Spirit to us, for doing that work for us, for sending off these warning signals to us, for taking us beyond that point, showing us how to respond and showing us the true significance of the death of Jesus for us. But let me end with one last word to anyone who knows that they're not yet a believer tonight. Here, as we've seen, are three warning lights, which Jesus tells us that God's Spirit will switch on in our experience. And the first one says we're wrong about Jesus. And the second one says that we're morally hopeless. And the third one says that we're spiritually clueless. And why does God bother to make our life uncomfortable in those three ways? Well, it's a mark of his concern for us. He wants to warn us, to show us the danger we're facing, so that we'll stop the car immediately. Turn to the Lord Jesus, who died for us, and ask for his forgiveness, and submit ourselves to his leadership over our lives. Oh, but of course, you could keep going, as if nothing was happening. You could keep on driving, as if those warning signals didn't mean anything. You could keep on going and do something about it later, when it seems more convenient. You could risk it, as you do if the petrol gauge is getting lower and lower, hoping you can go on for a few more miles or a few more years until you can decide that you're ready to respond. Or you could respond to those warning signals if you've experienced enough of them tonight, in a moment or two as we finish. Let me just say that that little orange light on the dashboard of my Morris 1000 did mean something after all. But it was too late by the time my friend found out. He'd be a fool to make the same mistake. Let's pray together, shall we? I suggest you pray in whatever way is appropriate for you. If you're a believer, why not thank God for those warning signals he sent you for showing you where you were heading? And if you're not a believer, then why not tonight use your own words silently and pull over, stop the engine, and ask for his forgiveness.